Welcome to Inside the Pages, insights from today's most compelling authors. I'm your host, Chris McGregor, and I'm delighted to be joined by Professor Jay Budiczewski, who is a professor of government and philosophy at the University of Texas at Austin. Among his several books are The Revenge of Conscience, Politics, and The Fall of Man, and The Line Through the Heart, Natural Law as Fact, Theory, and a Sign of Contradiction. With Professor Jay Budiczewski, we go inside the pages of What We Can't Not Know, the new revised edition, published by Ignatius Press.
Thank you so much for joining us.
I'm really glad to be on the show.
What We Can't Not Know, a double negative in the title.
Yes, that's right. I've had English teachers write to me to scold me for that, to chastise me. But I've told them that I get to do this. It's my book.
That's absolutely right. You get to do this. And I think it's because it is some of the best conversations that we can have are based on a paradox.
And well, Chesterton certainly thought so, didn't he? His whole style of writing was based on paradox, the great 20th century Catholic apologist. He was terrific.
He certainly was, and as you said, he's the king of the paradox, and I wonder what he would say about what we have come to now in the beginnings of this 21st century.
I don't think it would surprise him. Chesterton had said that the time was coming when we'd have to be lighting fires to testify that 2 and 2 is 4 and that grass is green in summer, because we were coming on the days when everything would be denied. And I've even used that as a sort of a quotation to introduce some of my arguments about natural law in some of my books, and I think he was absolutely right.
Mm. Talk to us about the natural law, will you? Help us to understand exactly what that means.
Sure. I think the term throws people because they think natural law, what is that, something like the law of gravity? But, you know, when we speak of falling objects following, say, the law of gravity, that's really only a metaphor, because a law is something addressed to a being that can understand what's expected of it. And a regularity built into nature like that isn't really an example of following a law. The stone doesn't understand what it's doing. We do understand what it's doing. The natural law is the moral law. It really is law, but we call it natural to signify that we're talking about the fact that it can be known not only from God's special revelation in words, from Scripture and Christian and apostolic tradition, but it can also be known from the way that He's built us, from the way that He has designed human nature. So it's a natural law. It's a built-in law. I don't mean by that we can't disobey it. But from the way that we are made, from the way that we're fashioned, it's clear what the law is.
It's something, isn't it, that from what I have gleaned from your writings, really breaks open the aha moments, and that we have those, you know, I knew that, but I didn't know I knew that.
Yes, I think that that's absolutely right. St. Paul had talked about the most important way that we know the natural law, which is conscience, in Romans 2, when he said that it's written on the heart. Now, it can be written on the heart, but you don't necessarily know that it's written there. So you're not walking around every day thinking of the, let's say, the Golden Rule. But somebody expresses to you the Golden Rule. It's the first time you've ever heard it. No one has ever expressed this to you before. And you say, yes, that makes sense. I did know that. I didn't know that I knew it. You might call that latent knowledge. It's real knowledge, but it's not conscious until something brings it to the surface. Unfortunately, this knowledge can not only be latent and pop to the surface, but it can also be suppressed. We push it down underneath. We don't want to listen to it. We put our fingers in our ears.
In the book, you do a beautiful job of outlining the different phases that have occurred historically in our understanding of the natural law. Could you break that open for us?
You know, the natural law doesn't change, but the idea of natural law has had a history as we've come to understand the natural law. I mentioned that the first phase belonged to the ancient philosophers. The second phase, I say, belonged to the theologians. The third phase was during the Enlightenment, and we're in the fourth phase now. In the Enlightenment, I think the Enlightenment philosophers, many of them acknowledge that there is a God and that the moral law is in some way his work, that he is the author, the creator. But they wanted to forget. They wanted to ignore everything that one learns about all of that from Revelation. They thought what we can learn from nature alone is all we need to know. What we can figure out just by philosophical reasoning is enough. After all, it's natural law, so why should we be talking about Revelation?
Mm-hmm.
And they were afraid of doing that because they thought that it could lead to religious conflict, religious wars. And there have been religious wars. It's not unreasonable to be afraid of something like that. But, the problem is that there are some things about even our nature that come really clearly into focus only from the perspective of what you might call supernature, only from the perspective of grace and of revelation. So I think that what's happening now is that the theologians are coming back onto center stage. The Catholic Church in particular has emphasized that in order to really understand what's going on with the natural law, we have to understand how it comes to us in creation, how it comes to us how we receive it in the fall, and how it's delivered to us in redemption. We have to view it in terms of the whole history of salvation. Now, if we're talking, that means that if we're talking to other people and trying to find common ground, we're not trying to find who maybe don't share our religious traditions. We're not trying to find common ground by ignoring who we are, and we're not asking them to forget who they are either. We're going to be honest Christians, and they're going to be honest Jews or Muslims or whatever they are. But we're going to have to speak about what we have in common from the perspectives of our religious traditions, even though we don't have those religious traditions in common. And I think that that's actually going to be more fruitful. The Enlightenment philosophers wanted Jews and Christians and Muslims and atheists all to impersonate atheists and thought that that was the way to find common ground. And I don't think that's true. I think we're going to have a richer and more interesting conversation if the Jews and the Christians and the Muslims and the atheists are all honest about who they are and start talking from there.
I find it interesting that when you talk about the different phases, and we've gone from the phase three being the Enlightenment phase, and that time when they really tried to separate God from the discussion.
Or at least they didn't all separate God. Many of them did. But or at least to separate the Christian God.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they wanted the God of natural law theory to be just the unknown God that Paul came across an altar to in Athens so many centuries ago.
Yeah, it even that particular God in that the fact that in this fourth phase that we're entering into, that we would have to wait for the theologians to come around. You know, theologians, you would think, especially those Christian theologians, that this would be something that would be so acceptable. And yet that's where it has been challenged in the greatest regard, I would say, especially in the last half of the 20th century.
Yes, there have been even a lot of Christians who have thought that we have to follow the advice of the Enlightenment philosophers and try not to speak like Christians if we're going to speak about the natural law. And that's caused a backlash in other parts of the Christian community, because there have been some Christians who, quite rightly, said, well, wait a minute, we are Christians, our identity is in Christ, how else are we going to talk, who else are we going to be? And so they drew the wrong conclusion from that. Instead of saying, so let's talk about the natural law that we have in common from the perspective of our faith, instead they said, let's not talk about the natural law. This is some pagan kind of thing. This is some non-believing, agnostic or atheist kind of thing. We don't want to have anything to do with this. I think that one of the reasons why some of the faith communities, for example, in the Protestant world, some Lutherans, some evangelicals, some Calvinists, have been willing to speak about the natural law again is that they're beginning to realize that we don't have to suppress our identity in Christ in order to do that.
Yeah, there's. I am aware of, even within theological circles, of those who would try to bend the what we have come to understand the natural law to be, to accommodate social structures, so that we could have this quote-unquote common ground. For example, those who would say, gender compatibility should not necessarily be the criteria anymore for, say, the relationships between human persons, that somehow that male and female compatibility shouldn't be used as the basis of our understanding of what a marriage or relationship should be, and somehow that if oneness completes two people coming together, i.e. Making it acceptable then to have same-sex relationships, for example, that somehow that we should rethink the natural law in that way.
Yeah, usually people who speak like that don't have much patience for the natural law at all, because if you do look seriously at human nature, you are going to see that it's not a trivial fact that we come in two sexes. You're going to see that, as even the man on the street knows, that the two sexes of us are different from each other, mm-hmm. and that they need each other. They complete each other. Each seems to be spiritually and psychologically and intellectually equipped in some ways that the other one finds a little more difficult. So that if either sex ignores the other, we're asking for trouble. Now that's what happens if you take our nature seriously. But these people who want to suppress all of those facts, I think that they're not wrong to be seeking common ground, but they're seeking it the wrong way. They think that to find common ground, you've got to find neutral ground. You've got to, anything we might disagree about, you have to stop talking about. Well, there are people out there who want so-called gay marriage, so we have to stop talking about the complementarity of the sexes, and we have to talk about, well, if you throw out everything that you disagree about, you're also throwing out everything that there is to talk about. It doesn't make any sense to me. I think that in order to find common ground, there is no neutrality. We're going to have to find common ground in the thing that we have in common, which is our nature. And that's a slippery common ground, because some of us maybe don't want to stand on it. We may hold ideologies or views or resentments or desires that are very precious to us that we want to satisfy at all costs, that make us want to deny some things about our own nature, that put us at war with ourselves, so that our deepest longings, we demand to satisfy them in ways that make their satisfaction impossible. So there is this battle then between the two ways of finding common ground, the neutralist way, which is a fraud, and the natural law way.
Jay, in this discussion, I mean, ultimately, it's imperative that we have an appreciation of the natural law, what it is to speak about that, even in the basic everyday person, because it ultimately affects us, the everyday person.
It certainly does.
Because it has the opportunity for a violation of basic human dignity, whether our own or those we encounter, if we take the natural law out of our whole moral structure.
Yes. Now, I think that even some people who understand the importance of natural law misunderstand how to do that. They think that in order to speak to ordinary people, you know, the natural law really does correspond pretty much to the common moral sense of the plain person. It's a more philosophically elaborated doctrine, but it's making sense of that common sense. Now, how are we going to approach the ordinary person, though? Are we going to say, well, the natural law says, or let me tell you about sexual complementarity? He thinks he's being told an academic theory that has nothing to do with him. But if we speak in the language of the common sense perceptions that natural law theory clarifies, if we just say something like, you know, have you noticed that there are two kinds of us, men and women, and we seem to need each other? The other guy is going to say, yeah, you talk about complementarity, and he's going to say, what are you talking about? But you put that in the language of common sense, and of course he says, yes, he recognizes this, we can do that. Now, I think even here there are going to be some problems. You mentioned the problem with advocacy of so-called same-sex marriages earlier.
Mm-hmm.
But we're going to run into some problems with heterosexuals too, right?
Mm-hmm.
People are beginning to realize that the sexual disorder of our times, living together without marriage, so-called hooking up where people engage in bodily transactions with no expectation of commitment or even relationship. Sometimes they don't even know the other person's name. People are just beginning to catch on to the fact that we're not designed for this, that it doesn't make us happy, that it breeds misery. And I think that's how we have to talk about it.
That's why I think in your book, What We Can't Not Know, A Guide, that whole chapter where you cover the Ten Commandments and the value of our appreciation of that. I mean, you're approaching this from a faith, reason type of approach in which it brings, it gives once again validity to this tremendous gift that we have that helps us to interact as human persons with each other.
Yes, you know, it's no accident that even in cultures that have never heard of the Bible, that have never heard about the giving of the Ten Commandments, moral ideas, something like the Ten Commandments, have prevailed, that they've been found universally. I'm not saying that people live up to them, but they're out there. The Ten Commandments tell us don't steal. It's very difficult to find a culture that says, oh, go steal. The Ten Commandments say, be faithful to your spouse. Well, you can find cultures that disagree about whether you can have one wife or four, but you're not going to find one, a whole culture that says, no, be unfaithful to your spouse. That's really better. These ideas are universal. And a lot of stuff comes along with them. When we're talking about the Ten Commands, we're not just talking about ten do's and don'ts.
Mm-hmm.
For instance, the command to be faithful to your spouse presupposes that there is this institution of marriage, and that leads you to think about the natural institution of the family, and so the mind is led step by step to many other things here. That all comes along with it, and these things are recognized pretty much universally too.
It helps us to fashion what we understand to be our conscience and the value of how that helps us to operate not only in how we treat ourselves and how we respect ourselves, but how we respect others and how society can function in a healthy way. But conscience needs to be formed, doesn't it? And how do we do that so it's not, I'm going to do what I think I need to do and you do what you think you need to do?
Well, there are two aspects to conscience. We tend to overlook this today. We speak of conscience as one thing. We imagine that it's just pumped in from the outside by socialization. You know, your parents tell you something, and the church tells you something, and the policeman tells you something, and your teachers tell you something, and some of that something gets inside you and makes a conscience. That's really misleading. Conscience is two things, not one, as the older natural law thinkers recognized. There's a part that is universal. It isn't pumped in from the outside. I call this deep conscience. The ancient term was synderesis. It is the built-in capacity to recognize the most fundamental principles of right and wrong, of good and evil. You know, you don't have to be taught that you shouldn't gratuitously harm your neighbor to see that it's wrong to do that. When parents teach a child don't pull your sister's hair. How would you like it if your hair was pulled? The child responds to that because he can see for himself that that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the root idea that you shouldn't treat somebody as you wouldn't want to be treated yourself makes sense to him. That's because of sundaresis. That's because of deep conscience. Now, surface conscience, where we're actually taking these principles and applying them to the decisions where we have to make, that does need forming. And the whole task of forming it is to get it to get surface conscience to correspond to and to be faithful to deep conscience. So teaching is still important. You have to elicit what we, in one sense, already know. We have to get people to draw the further implications of what, in some sense, we already know. We have to confront people with it and say, you know better than that. And this is a task of moral formation, reinforcement, confrontation, being held accountable, developing the virtues, and that's a lifelong work, and it's not just for the individual, but it's a civilizational work.
In a very concrete way, you demonstrated for us what this looks like in the world. You brought forward a conversation, for example, or can I call it a conversation? It actually was more of an unbelievable debate that occurred between Senator Rick Santorum and Senator Barbara Boxer on the House floor in the Senate when the partial birth abortion bill was being debated by the Senate. Works and can be discussed in today's society, isn't it?
Yes, it is. I quote the conversation from Senate transcripts right in the book, and it's absolutely astonishing. He was pressing Senator Boxer on when it was okay to kill this child, since she thought that you could kill the child in utero, you could kill the child in the process of being born. She opposed the protection of infants born alive who somebody had meant to abort but had not succeeded in aborting. So when is the child protected? And she says, I'm paraphrasing, but she says, in effect, when you get it home. No protection. That's absolutely astonishing, but you know, you can use things like that to educate people because it does shock their conscience. And you can say, well, all right. Now, why are we shocked here? What is it that we're recognizing to be true? And, you know, help people to connect the dots, to go on and to take the next step.
And it's important that we get shocked, I think. I mean, there is a point where it's often given as a quotation from Jane Fonda when she says, but how can it be wrong when I so sincerely believe that it's true? That there are those who have it believe so sincerely, and yet it's so wrong, and it's as demonstrated maybe by nations. I'm sure those in Germany thought what they were doing during World War II when they were marching the Jews to those camps, that somehow they were so... they believed what they were doing was based somehow in truth.
Well, there are two things to talk about there. One is what the Nazis really believed, and I'd like to come back to that.
Mm-hmm.
But the other is about how necessary it is to shock people. I do think that we need to go ahead and shock people sometimes. But I think that that's something that has to be done very, very carefully.
Mm-hmm.
Because most of the time, you know, it's our adversaries who are using shock techniques in order to wear down our moral resistance.
Mm.
And an overuse of shock techniques can scandalize people, can make them want to shoot the messenger instead of to correct the situation that the messenger is talking about.
Mm-hmm.
So I absolutely agree with you. We're in complete agreement that these techniques are sometimes needed. I think they also have to be used with care.
Mm-hmm.
So we don't overload people and demoralize them instead of, shall we say, moralize them?
Well said, yeah.
Now, about the Nazis, you know, it's very interesting. We say, well, they must have sincerely believed that these that these Jews whom they were leading off to gas chambers were animals. They said they were. Their propaganda said they were, and they were certainly acting as though they were. But, you know, we have evidence that deep down, even the Nazis knew better. The psychologist Robert J. Lifton reports an interview with a former Wehrmacht neuropsychiatrist who had treated large numbers of death camp soldiers for very terrible psychological symptoms. The men had the hardest time shooting women and children.
Mm.
And if they thought that they were animals, why should they find that difficult? And they had nightmares in which their victims accused them. I think it's very unlikely that a hunter would have nightmares of his prey accusing him, or that a fisherman would have nightmares of the fish accusing him.
Mm-hmm.
Deep down, mm-hmm. not only did they know that it was wrong to deliberately take innocent human life, but they knew that their pretenses that the Jews were neither innocent nor human were false. They really were innocent, and they really were human, and they were doing something terrible.
Mm.
So this was not a case of moral ignorance. This was a case of moral denial, of self-deception, of an attempt to hold down the conscience, to stuff one's fingers in one's ears when the conscience was actually trying to tell them the truth. Now, I think that we see that with abortion and many other things in our own society, too. It's very terrible, the way that the conscience strikes back at us when we violate her.
Mm. It's a fascinating book that you've brought to us. Actually, it's the revised and expanded edition of What We Can't Not Know. It puts the emphasis on, we need to know this stuff. We do know this stuff. It's written in our hearts. It's bringing that totality of that journey from the head to the heart and allowing it to help us to be whole persons, isn't it?
Yes, it is. And I think that's so important, because all the voices in our society keep telling us to not be whole persons, to be part persons, to deny our own personhood, to depersonalize ourselves, to be less than what we are and what God calls us to be. And that's advice that we really dare not take.
Perfect. And I think just the beginning of a wonderful exploration of what's been written on the human heart.
I hope so. Thanks. I've enjoyed being on your program, being interviewed.
We've been going inside the pages of What We Can't Not Know with Professor Jay Budiceski. To learn more about this book or to obtain a copy, go to Ignatius.com, the website for Ignatius Press, or you can find it at any fine Catholic bookstore. To hear and download this discussion along with many others, go to www.insidethepages.com. I'm your host, Chris McGregor. Join me next time for Inside the Pages, insights from today's most compelling authors.